Thanks, Dick. Well, I live in Washington, D.C., and so I want to do a little sort of defining of terms here, because the word libertarian is a complicated term. And so if you go to a Tea Party rally, probably in Montana, I haven't tested this, I'm guessing it would be very much like if you went to a Tea Party rally in Texas. There are a lot of people who refer to themselves as libertarians. Maybe some of you in this room do that. And at least my experience is that what you probably mean by that is you believe in a limited government. You think that the government has a really basic but very limited role to do. You believe in individual rights. You believe in the virtues and the value of a market economy. You believe in using reason and these kinds of things. And the problem is that's not what the word means in certain places, and especially in very, very large areas such as New York and Washington, D.C. and California. In those places, the word libertarian for the most part actually refers to a very, very secular mindset and a particular ideology which is all about individual self-assertion, so that you evaluate everything based on whether it's allowing you to sort of do what you want to do or not. And so obviously that's going to have affinities. You're going to not like a big government because it's telling you what to do. But it also is not necessarily a virtuous attitude, because you might be really interested in, again, this is not the virtuous life. Doing whatever the heck you want to do is not the virtuous life. And so as a result, what happens is that you end up in campaigns, you know, like libertarians in Seattle, for instance. I lived there for many years, and you could probably guess what the number one libertarian issue in Seattle was: pot smoking, right? So that absolutely essential cultural issue of our time is whether or not you get to smoke pot. Now, you can argue about the war on drugs and all that sort of thing, but this doesn't seem to me to be the most significant kind of issue you could spend time on. The free access to pornography and various things like that end up being very important issues. And so you realize that what has happened for a lot of people is that they mix up a kind of atheistic idea in which I get to do whatever I want to do, and nobody's going to, not only is no government going to tell me what I'm going to do, no God's going to tell me what I want to do. And so you can see how that would lead to a certain kinds of free market, small government ideas, right, that could be appealing to many of us in this room and appealing to me, but you still got something different going on here. This is not just the same as kind of small government conservatism, and also it's often very confused and mixed up with atheism. And so what I did about a year ago is I started thinking, gosh, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because they'll have somebody that is a really hardcore atheist, and yet they believe in things like individual rights, human rights, they believe in limited government and reason and freedom. They're moral realists. So in other words, they think there's certain moral truths, that it is immoral for the government to coerce people to do things that they don't believe in. It would be immoral that a government would force someone to have particular religious beliefs, for instance, or force them to be baptized or not to be baptized, right? That's moral realism. That's not relativism. And so if you ever talk to anyone that refers to him or herself as a libertarian, they are inevitably morally passionate about things. And it occurred to me that these things, freedom and individual responsibility, individual rights, reason, moral realism, and limited government. Oh, yeah. Oh, good. Okay, so no, I think that's going to work, because that's my desktop right there. Let me just pull it up. That these things don't make a whole lot of sense in the atheist worldview. And in fact, they don't fit at all if you look at what the leading atheist and materialist philosophers say about these ideas. So the experts, right? So, you know, if you want to know, okay, what are the implications of materialism for this idea? You can go ask the leading or read the leading atheists, and they will tell you exactly what the implications of their idea are for that issue. And when you do that, what you discover is that none of these things that atheist libertarians say they believe in makes a bit of sense, given the atheistic worldview. And that what they're probably doing is they're sort of cafeteria theists. They're actually pulling ideas that are naturally the property and are naturally originate from a kind of broadly theistic or Judeo-Christian context. Now, theistic, what theism is it's just, think of theism as kind of the philosophical core of different views of reality, all of which believe that ultimate reality is a transcendent and personal God, right? So there's not a religion, there's not the first church of theism anywhere, right? What theism is it's the things that people that believe in a single transcendent and personal God hold in common. All right, so it's not any particular religion. Does that make sense? And so what this means is that there are theists, certainly all Jews and Christians have a lot of things in common, but Muslims also hold certain core ideas that are theistic. So you would describe Islam as a theistic religion. Different view of God, but it's still theistic. There are forms of Hinduism that are theistic. You think of all of Hinduism as polytheistic, but there are actually some theistic threads. Baha'i is theistic. And so that's what theism is. And what I'm convinced of is that all these ideas, freedom and individual responsibility and human individual rights, make a heck of a lot of sense in a theistic worldview and just virtually no sense at all in a materialist worldview. And so this, unlike any of the other talks, is a straight-out philosophy argument that's designed not to prove that free markets are true or good or anything like that, but that if you believe in those things, it makes a lot more sense for you to be a theist than for you to be an atheist. And I've tested this. I've just been talking about this issue for about a year, but I've done it in some sort of high-pressure situations with people that are hardcore libertarian atheists, and so I know what the response is. It's disturbance is the general response. It's not mass conversions, but it's like, what I encountered is that people aren't thinking carefully about these things. So here's what I'm going to, let's call these the core libertarian values. So I'm not talking about the Libertarian Party platform. I'm talking about these ideas that we'd call libertarian values that virtually everyone that calls himself a libertarian would hold, but certainly American conservatives. American conservatism is a weird thing because it's actually a combination of moral traditionalism and classical liberalism. Limited government, individual rights, free markets, that is classical liberalism. But then it also includes a moral traditionalist element. Whereas conservatism in Europe generally refers to nationalism and sometimes has a racial element to it. And so a European that refers to himself as a liberal might very well be an American conservative. So these words actually end up being almost completely useless, which is why I tend not to use the word liberal, except in the right context. So here's the sort of core libertarian values. And so the question is this. I'm not making an argument for the existence of God or against materialism so much as I'm saying, given those ideas, those values, back here, individual rights, freedom and individual responsibility, reason, moral realism, and limited government. We've got them up here. Now we're going to compare them with respect to these two different worldviews and say, where do they fit more nicely? Right? So if these ideas are true, what would need to be true for those to be true? And notice that's different intellectually from saying building an argument and the conclusion is the existence of God. What we're saying is we're comparing worldviews with respect to ideas that we already hold. So what we're doing is we're saying, what would you need to believe about the nature of reality in order to be coherent if you think there's this thing called freedom that we can exercise? And so what I want to do here for a few minutes this morning is I'm not going to just make a sort of argument abstractly. I'm going to show you specific quotes from leading materialists and atheists weighing in on the implications of their worldview for every one of these ideas. And these aren't obvious libertarian thinkers, these are philosophers that are atheists for the most part. And what they tell you is if you're an atheist libertarian, quite distressing. And so the arguments I'm making here are designed for people who think of themselves as libertarians, but are also atheists. They're designed for those people. And so in other words, any good argument is an argument, like let's say as you're a Christian and you're trying to prove to something to someone that's not a Christian, right? Saying, well, appealing to the authority of Scripture is a non-starter. Right? Now why? Well, because they don't accept Scripture as an authority. You're appealing to an authority you accept, but not one they accept. Any good argument is going to be an argument that appeals to something they already hold to be true or to be authoritative. And so a good argument is going to be something that takes them from where they are to where you hope they will come. That's just the nature of good argumentation. And so the purpose of this argument is not for the average atheist, it's for the average atheist that also holds these values. And it's appeal for them to be consistent. And so you may, in the various circles that you travel, encounter people like this. And so I just want you to kind of remember the basics of this. And if you're interested in really getting into the argument in detail, I actually published an article last year that's available free online. And it's exactly the same title, Why Libertarians Need God. So you can actually just Google it and read it if you want. So let's go through these values real quickly. The first one is individual rights. Now, we all know What's funny about the concept of individual rights is that no one has ever formulated the individual rights in a coherent way unless they at least implicitly appealed to a creator. It's a very weird thing. So Thomas Jefferson, right, who was, we'll say, complicated theologically, all right, and so not maybe the founder that you would want to pick if you were going to pick one for your theology, that you would pick Thomas Jefferson. Nevertheless, when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, in which he asserted rights, explicitly appealed to the Creator. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. It says unalienable, by the way, in the Declaration, not inalienable. That among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They went back and forth on the unalienable, inalienable thing. And so if you go to the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., they have another quote from Jefferson that uses inalienable. And so I did a documentary a few years ago called The Birth of Freedom. And so I thought, I got to go get a scan of the Declaration and see what it actually says. It says unalienable. I know you were all dying to know that, but it was a big argument. And everybody was telling me, no, it's inalienable. And so I was like, here's a scan. Look what it says. All right, well, what is he doing? He's saying, okay, there are these things. We hold them to be self-evident. That's a weird kind of claim, but what he's saying is that if you understand the truth about man, what man actually is, it follows simply from his nature that he has a particular dignity and a proper end that ought to be respected, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It has to do with what you are. This is not something that is conferred on you by a government or another person. It's based on your nature as created by God. Now, that was Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. After World War II, the UN was created, and there was an attempt to develop what's called the UN Declaration on Human Rights. And they very much wanted to come up with a secular foundation for these ideas. They failed. They ended up having to appeal to a Catholic French philosopher named Jacques Maritain, who had an idea of human rights that, guess what, was theological, it was Christian. But they realized intuitively they wanted individual rights. Everybody knew in their hearts that this is true, this is good, we need to treat our fellow human beings as equals and not as chattel slaves and these sorts of things. They didn't have a philosophical basis for it, so they just finally said, okay, well, we'll use this one at hand. And so that's sort of the state of the debate. This is so powerful an idea that even committed atheists appeal to it. Here's what Ayn Rand said. She was a deeply committed, vocal atheist for her entire life, so far as we know. Here's what she said. Man, every man, that is every human being, is an end in himself, not the means to the ends of others. Now, where do you get that? Right? That's just floating up there in midair. And yet she was convinced enough that it was true that she could just assert it without argument. I think what she's doing is she's drawing on both the natural law that Paul talks about in Romans, it's written on the human heart, so that she kind of knows intuitively there's something different about human beings, but she was also drawing interest from a Judeo-Christian culture that she had partially imbibed. And this is what a lot of our fellow Americans do. They draw on ideas that have sources that they disagree with without fully realizing it. And so one apologetic method is just to help them to become aware of these things that they're taking for granted as true, but don't really follow from what they claim to be true. So what do atheists have to say about this idea of individual rights and intrinsic dignity? Well, atheists in general that are consistent say, not only do we not have rights, there are no human individuals. There are no persons. And this follows, and this is how crazy, it sounds crazy to you, I know, but if everything is ultimately matter in motion, blind forces, right, well, atoms and quarks, they don't have wills and purposes, right? They conform to certain kinds of laws, and they do things under certain conditions. If that's fundamental reality, then everything's built up from that. We are built up from that, and so everything that we are is ultimately to be explained in terms of blind forces. And so not only can there be no individual freedom, there can be no individuals. That is humans, persons that do stuff. This is how B.F. Skinner put it in a book in the middle of the 20th century. B.F. Skinner was the founder of behaviorism, a psychological movement. The book is called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Now, I normally don't do this. This is not best practice to show a big quote, but I'm doing this to show you so you can actually see for yourselves what the experts say about these things. Here's what he says. Autonomous man has been constructed from our ignorance. Autonomous means to be able to exercise, you know, sort of individual control. And as our understanding increases, the very stuff of which he is composed vanishes. To man, qua man, that is as man, we readily say good riddance. Only by dispossessing him can we turn to the real causes of human behavior. Only then can we turn from the inferred to the observed, from the miraculous to the natural, from the inaccessible to the manipulable. All right, the miraculous. So notice that, in other words, this idea that there are people walking around that are able to make choices that somehow transcend their physical composition, that's like invoking fairies or something. It doesn't make any sense. That's just straight materialism. There are no individuals. And so there, of course, can be no freedom or responsibility. Here's how Bertrand Russell put it. Bertrand Russell was one of the most prominent English-speaking philosophers of the 20th century, also an atheist. And here's what he said, because we have this kind of, he said, we have this naive idea that if somebody does something bad, that they're responsible for it, so they ought to be punished for it. He says, you know, that's a primitive and kind of silly idea. So when a man acts in ways that annoy us, we wish to think him wicked, and we refuse to face the fact that his annoying behavior is the result of antecedent causes, causes that come before, which if you follow them long enough, will take you beyond the moment of his birth and therefore to events for which he cannot be held responsible by any stretch of the imagination. All right, in other words, every one of us is simply the sum total of all these things that have happened historically, all the way back to the beginning of time, sort of proceeding deterministically, and they eventually get to us, right? But we have absolutely no more control over that than an electron has over control of, you know, where it's going to go as a result of colliding with another one or something like that. That's just the logic of materialism. This isn't rocket science. It's just, if you think this is true, this is what follows from it. All right, so this is the reason. You can think of the individual under materialism like this, is that the individual is the sum total of nature and nurture. So nature is, you know, the laws of physics, the laws of chemistry, all these kinds of things, weird things that happen biologically, that eventually give rise to certain chemical reactions in your brain and those sorts of things. And then nurture, which would just be maybe your upbringing and your environment. Problem is, even that ultimately is the result of nature, too. But, you know, roughly speaking, we talk about the effects of both your environment and your genetics and all those kinds of things. And that's just all there is. What else could there possibly be? That's the story. And so what that means, it may be too complicated to trace, but you are just the sum total of nature and nurture that gave rise to you at this very moment, and nothing else. That's the end of the story. All right, well, there's something that philosophers call libertarian freedom. It's the same word. It doesn't refer to libertarian politics. What libertarian freedom refers to is the kind of freedom we all assume that we have. And what libertarian freedom means is, if you have libertarian freedom, that's not just freedom to do what you want to do. Right, you could be doing what you want to do and still be determined. So, for instance, imagine there's a mad scientist that can put something in your cerebral cortex, and with a little machine, let's say an Xbox player console, he can control what you do. But it goes through your brain, so what happens is that you, the first thing that happens, you get a thought, I want to do this. Huh, I want to clean out the latrine for this army division today. And you really want to do it, right? And he does it, and you do it. You're doing what you want to do. But you know that's not free, because you've been controlled by somebody else that's made you do it. So that would be, you're doing what you want to do, but that by itself is not enough to have freedom. What freedom is the capacity to choose between alternatives without being fully determined which one you choose. If you can choose between alternatives, at least sometimes, it doesn't mean you do that all the time. In fact, most of the time we do stuff on automatic pilot. And be thankful that you do. What if every time, oh wait, think, oh, breathe, yeah, blink. Right? It's good that most of this stuff, you know, is on autopilot so that you can focus on more important things. But libertarian freedom says that sometimes at least you can exercise this ability to choose among alternatives. And for that to be true, something like this has to be true. Yes, of course we're shaped by our nature and our nurture. Your upbringing is going to shape very much the kind of foods you like. Your genetic endowment and the sort of state of your stomach can affect your moods and all these kinds of things. So these shape who we are. But if we really have choice, then something like an agent has to exist. That is, an entity that is actually able to choose and so transcend while being shaped by our backgrounds. All right, so there has to be an agent between all these previous causes and what we do, at least sometimes. And so for Skinner and for Bertrand Russell, this is a miracle. How can this possibly have a place in a materialistic universe? What's this thing? Right? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't fit in the furniture of a materialistic universe. But that is exactly what every human being that's ever lived as an adult has believed they had. We think, in fact, much more basically, we experience this much more directly than we experience any fancy philosophical argument. Right? You experience directly your sense of freely choosing things and know it more precisely and directly than you could possibly know any truth of history or science or anything like that. And so the implications of materialism is the thing you know most basically can't be true. Right? That's how radical it is. And so it's only going to be kind of crazy philosophers that are willing to trace out the consequences of crazy ideas to their end that are going to tell you what it really means. And so that's why it's valuable. All right? So freedom, responsibility, and the individual doesn't make a darn bit of sense. What about reason? Ludwig von Mises, the famous 20th century Austrian economist, talking about too many subjects, who talks a lot. He says that the free market and capitalism appeal to the rational and dispassionate mind. For anyone who is capable of actually following evidence and arguments through to their conclusion, they will be convinced of the free market. So he made arguments from reason. And libertarians always do this, right? We did a bunch of this kind of stuff last night. So what is reason for the materialist? Well, what's funny is if you sort of think about this and think especially about what Darwinism, full Darwinism, I don't mean, okay, natural selection explains some things. I mean Darwin's full story that everything we see around us in life is ultimately the result of blind processes of natural selection and random variation over time. But that ends up being really corrosive of the idea of reason. And in fact, Darwin himself, in The Origin of Species, actually admitted this. It's sometimes called Darwin's doubt. Here's what Darwin said. "With me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the conviction of one's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind, if there are any convictions in such a mind?" You see his point? He's using his reason to develop his theory, and then he realizes that an implication of his theory is that his reason and his mind had to come from something prior to him that was not itself reasonable. Right? Now that's worrying. And even Darwin himself, this shows you in many ways how intellectually honest he was. He realized, there could be a problem here. He managed to suppress it. And as I said, that's called Darwin's doubt. And in fact, this argument I'm going to show you very lightly, I think, is one of the most powerful arguments ever developed by a Christian philosopher in the 20th century. I'm going to give it to you very lightly, but if you're interested, I'll give you ways to follow up on it. Okay, now this has actually been developed. So that was what Darwin said in the 1850s. Materialist philosophers, especially in neuroscience, have been making this point ever since then. Now, the next slide is going to be a little bit unsavory, so I'm warning those of you who have kids here, but this is the best distillation that I've ever seen of the argument, which is that natural selection, if it has produced our bodies and our minds and our reason, is not concerned about truth, it's concerned about survival. It's a survival instrument. It can be relied upon to keep us doing survival-enhancing things. There's no reason to think it'll give us truth. This is what Patricia Churchland, who's a philosopher at MIT, said it. She said, "Boiled down to essentials, the nervous system enables the organism to succeed in the four Fs, feeding, fleeing, fighting, and reproducing." So I warned you. "The principal chore of the nervous system is to get the body parts where they should be in order that the organism may survive. It doesn't matter what your mind believes about what you're doing, as long as it causes you to run from lions and run from fire and run toward food, right? What your body's doing, it needs to get the body parts where it is, but there's no reason to think that what it's believing is based on truth, right? In fact, there's very little reason to believe that." She goes on, she says, "Improvements in sensorimotory control, moving our bodies like this, right, control an evolutionary advantage, a fancier style of representing, is advantageous so long as it's geared to the organism's way of life and enhances the organism's chances of survival. Truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost." All right, now this is a leading philosopher of mind that says truth, if Darwinism is true, The full story. I don't mean aspects of the theory. I mean the full story is true. This idea of truth, whatever it is, it doesn't make any sense. There's no reason to think the system would produce that. Now, you might think, well, no, wouldn't it be survival-enhancing to believe true things? And so wouldn't natural selection give rise to true beliefs? And so that's always the kind of initial intuition. And you can see that that's not true, but unfortunately, the argument's a little bit complex. I don't know how many of you have heard of Alvin Plantinga. He's a Christian philosopher, now he's in his 80s, taught at Calvin College in Notre Dame, probably the most important Christian philosopher still living. Has developed an argument over 20 years called the evolutionary argument against naturalism. And his argument is essentially this, that if Darwinism and naturalism are both true, then it's very unlikely that our minds give rise to true beliefs. All right, so he said, you know, now let's say theism and common descent are true. That's different. So common descent would be the idea that all organisms share a common ancestor, but God has guided it. It's like creation on the installment plan. Right, whether that's true or false, that wouldn't have the same problem because you'd have a God guiding things to certain ends, right? So what Plantinga said is we've got to combine both naturalism and materialism and the Darwinian story. And when you do that, what you discover is it's very unlikely to give you what we all think we have, which is the ability to grasp truth. Now here's the argument, alas. It's actually not nearly as complicated as it looks, okay? So I won't even read it to you, but I want to at least give it to you there. So yeah, you can take a picture of it with your iPhone so you can spend hours with it tonight. Yeah, you can blow it up. All right, so essentially what it says, and I won't do the whole darn thing, this just means the probability of R, and R is the reliability that we have, belief producing faculties, right? That we have belief producing faculties that allow us to develop beliefs that can be reliable, that lead to truth. The probability that we have reliable belief-producing faculties given naturalism and Darwinian evolution is very, very low. All right, and so the whole thing goes through, and basically what it says is that because of this, because you have to use your reason to ever come to the conclusion that naturalism and Darwinian evolution are true, you end up never having a rational basis for believing those. And so these ideas end up undercutting themselves. They're like the snake that consumes its tail, right? Philosophers call these a self-refuting argument, right? It's like sitting on a branch that you're sawing on, right? And so you're using reason to get yourself to a conclusion, and the conclusion is that reason can't possibly be reliable, right? This is a problem for a worldview. It's sort of the worst one you can have. Now, why is this? Well, because you might think, okay, well, but no, like if I have true beliefs, won't that cause me to do good things? And so natural selection, working over long periods of time, it would select for those people that have true beliefs rather than the false beliefs. That sounds intuitive, but you've got to think about the full picture. And then you realize that what happens is natural selection is actually blind to beliefs that are inside your head. Natural selection can't pick, oh, that's a true belief and that's a false belief. What can natural selection pick? It could pick your action. Right? If a tribe is a little faster or they run from lions, right, on the African savanna, natural selection could preserve them. And let's say there's another tribe nearby, when they see lions, they're like, oh, these cute kitties, and they run toward them, right? It's not the beliefs, it's what they're doing that natural selection is selecting. And so whatever stupid thing you believe in your head, in fact, the people running from the lions might think, cute kitties, let's get them to chase after us. And then we can play with them. Right now, it's a dumb false belief. But as long as they're running away, natural selection will select for that tribe. You see the point? So natural selection doesn't know what beliefs are in your head. It can only preserve actions or external features that enhance your chances of survival. All right, so here's the sort of big Darwinian backstory. So the basic story is, the points here are not the sort of time scales, but what I want you to get is a kind of sweep of history. And you have to detach the possibility of God guiding this, right? So I'm talking about the full materialistic story. There's no God behind any of this stuff, all right? And so you've got, the early Earth, and you've got interesting chemicals and various things happening in warm ponds and electricity and stuff, and you eventually get first protocell, and you eventually get a reproducing cell about, maybe 4 billion years ago, and then you get simple one-celled bacteria for several billion years, and then about 500 million years ago, you get multicellular organisms and animals and plants, right? Now we're up about here, right? And then you get mammals, you get higher animals, mammals, you get primates, And then somewhere in here, right, do sea invertebrates, do you think they have beliefs? Like jellyfish, do you think they're thinking, gosh, I think I'll go over here now? No, they don't have brains, right? So you figure natural selection would be working on them. So if the jellyfish does something that gives it survival advantage, it could preserve that, right? But natural selection has been working and shaping the history of life for billions of years. And then somewhere in here, beliefs suddenly pop up, right? Now, so does it make any sense to think that the beliefs have any sort of truth or truth or falsehood value, or even that they really have anything to do with anything? In fact, what would the beliefs be? Beliefs would be chemical reactions that get cast off from some metabolic process. That's all they could be. And so natural selection can affect the behaviors all the way up to here, but there's just going to be beliefs. There could be all sorts of crazy things you've got in your head, but there's no reason natural selection would preserve them. That's the idea. That's Darwin's doubt. You see how corrosive that is and how intense that is. And that's the real worry, and a lot of philosophers worry a lot about this. I think it's not true, so I don't actually spend any time worrying about it, but this is their problem, not our problem, right? All right? And so now why is this? Well, because if you're a materialist, the only thing that a belief can be, because what is a belief? Think about it for a minute. So right now you believe that you're listening to some guy talk about some kind of boring argument, right? That's, you believe that. You've got a thought. What is it, though? Is it a, could you measure it? How much does it weigh? Right? It's something, and it's weird. It somehow relates to your mind, but that subjective experience you have, that is, as a person, you're thinking about something. Or your act of thinking about, I see pink, I see red, right? That's not a physical object. And so what would it mean to say that my belief could cause an action? What you would be saying is that there are these immaterial things out there in the universe that can actually cause physical actions. Well, that just, again, makes no sense for the materialist. And so for a materialist, beliefs can be one of two things. They can either be electrochemical patterns in your brain, right, and that's just all they are, and those patterns somehow connect to other sort of physical actions, or maybe that's called the reductive physicalist view. It's just this electrochemical reaction, sort of pattern, right, and it happens to correlate to you acting in certain ways. Or number two, the non-reductive physicalist, there are these kind of subjective beliefs that pop up for some weird reason of evolutionary history, but they can't cause anything. So the structure in your brain is the physical thing that's really causing stuff. And then what's dependent on them is the belief that's along for the ride. All right, so maybe you do have beliefs, but they don't actually cause anything. They can't, right? Because the belief itself is determined by all this other stuff that's been happening. Let that sink in. Because the implications of the materialist worldview, at least the best account, right? This is the best argument materialists have for how we got brains and bodies. It's the best that's going. They guard it zealously. If you run it out to its conclusion, it says that you don't have a mind and your beliefs don't probably have any truth value, right? And they don't lead you to true conclusions. That's just as bad as it can possibly get for a worldview, right? So needless to say, people don't like this argument very much. So as a result, really consistent atheists even say, well, even thinking itself isn't really about anything. That's what a philosopher named Alex Rosenberg said in a book called The Atheist Guide to Reality a few years ago. All right? It's an ironic title. And remember when you're thinking about this, that he wrote this book so people would read it and be persuaded. I want you to feel the irony of that, okay? The notion that thoughts are about stuff is illusory. It's an illusion. Think of each input-output neural circuit as a single still photo. Now put together a huge number of input-output circuits in the right way. None of them is about anything. Each is just an input-output circuit firing or not. It's an electrical reaction, period, and it's not about anything. And so that's not about anything either, ha-ha, you know. Now isn't that strange? That's where you end up. That's where you end up. So you might not be able to prove that that's a false worldview, but we have every reason to believe that if it's true, you'd never have any good basis for believing it's true. That's the sort of outcome of this. All right, moral realism. That was I spent by far the most time on that because it is admittedly complicated. And I didn't get that argument the first time it was described to me. The description may not have been great, or I just didn't quite get it. But if it didn't fully sink in, I encourage you to spend some time on it because it's actually very encouraging when you get what's going on. That these people that act like they've got all the smarts and all the arguments in their favor have just shot themselves in the foot, and most of them don't seem to know it. Now, that's not the way you put it to your atheist friend, right? And this is not, that's not a good, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, moral realism. Now, as I said, and you can imagine where this is going, right, that libertarians overwhelmingly are moral realists. They believe there are certain moral truths, that it is morally wrong for people to be forced to do certain things, for instance, right? You should not be forced to be a Christian or forced to be an atheist. You should be free to make up your mind. And so they're just constantly making moral judgments in which they think that moral ideas are true about stuff out there in the world. That's what moral realism is. Well, again, what's funny is if you look at the atheist philosophers, in this case, Michael Ruse and E.O. Wilson, who are leading thinkers, a scientist and a philosopher, and leading Darwinian thinkers, if anybody that's involved in the sort of Darwin debate knows these guys. And here's what they say about moral realism, is that our sense that certain things are right and wrong, that certain things are bad or good, those senses, those are the result of selection for survival, not for truth. Here's how they put it. So morality, or more strictly our belief in morality, is merely an adaptation put in place to further our reproductive ends. In an important sense, ethics as we understand it is an illusion fobbed off on us by our genes to get us to cooperate. It is without external grounding. Ethics is illusory inasmuch as it persuades us that it has an objective reference. All right, so you get the point? Here's the point. Why is it that as a culture we think it's wrong? I'm sorry, this is kind of grisly, but you brought them here, so you didn't know what you were going to get. So our culture generally thinks it's wrong to eat our children. All right, right? That's just not a good thing. People generally think, you really, in most situations, should not eat your children for dinner. Well, what Wilson and Ruse are saying is this. It's not that it's wrong to eat your children. Rather, yes, I know. Rather, what happened is that in history, right, in distant history, various cultures tried different things. And some cultures ate their children. It's like, what's for dinner? Oh, there's something, right? And so they did this. They didn't know any better. They ate their kids. And so guess what happened? Natural selection weeded them out, right, for obvious reasons. They didn't reproduce. They didn't spread their genes. And so you don't hear from those people, all right, because they died out. They're like the Shakers, all of whom were celibate. Well, that was fun, for one generation. So that's the problem. But some cultures in some places, some tribes and villages, got the idea it was wrong to eat their children. And so even when they were hungry and tempted to do so, they didn't. And so as a result, they reproduced, and here we are. Right? That's the point. We have morality. Cultures have true and false moral beliefs. We can't resist them, but they have no external reference. They're the result of natural selection acting at different times and places. And so when people did things, if you had a belief that didn't have a lot of selection value, you got weeded out of the gene pool. But it's not true. Right? Now, again, some of these moral beliefs, like that one, I picked that for a reason. It's wrong to torture your children for the fun of it. Right? Everybody knows that's true. Everybody knows that's true. And you know it immediately when you hear it. It's wrong to torture small children for the fun of it. Right? You just know it. You can't not believe it, and you know it more directly than you know anything that anybody can ever teach you. The implications of materialism is that that's an illusion. But if that's an illusion, why on earth would we believe highfalutin arguments from philosophy and history and science? Because that's more basic than anything else. I would think a better procedure would say, okay, what are those things that we think are almost certainly true and that we believe most directly? Say, what would need to be true for those to be true and work our way out from that. And then maybe we'd end up having a basis for believing truths of history and things like that. Right? So no moral realism. Thoughts aren't about anything. Our reason is not reliable. Right? There's nothing like individual rights or freedom or responsibility. In fact, there are no individuals or persons as we think of them. So this is a kind of shabby deal we have here, isn't it? If you're trying to make an atheist case for libertarianism, you're getting a lot of the planks kind of pulled out from under you. Now we come to the arguments for limited government. And what might they be? Well, let's make an argument. Oh, wait, we don't have access to reason. Well, let's appeal to the intrinsic dignity of human persons that the state, oh, wait, no, we don't get to have that, do we? Well, let's make moral arguments about how bad it is to use coercion against, oh, yeah, well, against people. Oh, no, that's right, we don't have right to the concept of person. You now don't have any arguments to make for the case for limited government. And so this is why, inevitably, in cultures that become atheistic, they don't end up libertarian paradises. They end up quite the opposite. That's the problem with being a libertarian and an atheist. As I mentioned a minute ago, it's suicidal reasoning. Suicidal reasoning means it's reasoning which destroys the very basis for reason. It's the guy sawing off the branch that he's sitting on. And you know, he, of course, he looks exactly like that guy. It's always one tooth and a flat upper lip. I don't know why that is, right? That's the universal symbol. But it's not a very smart thing to do, but the smartest intellectuals of the 20th century were more or less engaged in doing just that. Well, so how to avoid suicidal reasoning? Notice I haven't made an argument for the existence of God here. But what I've said is if you believe in individual rights, if you believe that there are moral truths that are true about reality, if you think that reason is sometimes reliable, if you think that you sometimes exercise freedom to choose among alternatives and you bear responsibility for some of your actions, if you believe that we ought to make the case for limited government and use reason to do that, you are much better off believing that ultimate reality gets down to a perfectly benevolent and good and intelligent being who has created the world so that material forces aren't fundamental. They derive from a personal and transcendent being. And so if you believe those already, you're much better off being a theist than an atheist. It's a different kind of argument, but it is an argument designed precisely for people that already believe those things. So with that, we'll end and maybe take a few questions. Thank you very much.